Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of the wonderful city of London. I also serve the Reina Mission and helping to look after St. Columba up in East Kilbride, Scotland. I'd like to invite you along to attend a worship service at any of these congregations or any of the other ELCE congregations. To find the church you live closest to, go to lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button, and find the times and the location of the service nearest to you. We'd also like to thank you for your prayerful and your financial support of Lutheran Radio UK, because without your prayers and without your financial assistance, we wouldn't be able to carry on this wonderful outreach of the gospel of Jesus Christ around the world. And today, we would like to welcome Professor Jeffrey Pulse. He teaches Old Testament exegetical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And one of the classes he teaches is the book of Job. So we've invited Professor Pulse to come and have a word with us about Job. He says one of the reasons he teaches the class is it gives him Job security. And so I applaud him for that. But Dr. Pulse, welcome to Lutheran Radio.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
It's lovely to have you back with us. And as we look at this book of Job, I mean, there are so many things that I'm puzzled about when we do. But one of the first things that puzzles me is how it opens. Here we are in the throne room, the court of God, where he and the angels and all the heavenly hosts are having this meeting. And Satan comes in. That sounds a little strange to the modern reader. Can you help elucidate us on this and tell us what this all might mean?
Well, there's a couple of things going on there, I think, that actually inform our discussion of Job later. However, it is quite an interesting, if you will, scenario. The throne room, you brought that up. Well, I think that's kind of important because that's not an atypical understanding in the Middle Eastern culture of that time or in the genre. And Job goes back. It's old. It's a very old story. Now, we argue back and forth vociferously about who wrote it or when it was written, but it's definitely an old story. Whether it was written up later, was followed as an oral tradition earlier, or whatever, it's some old stuff. And maybe even east of Cana a little bit, maybe into the country of Edom, it follows some of those, the genre that we find there. So you have this visual that's brought up with the king on his throne, surrounded by his servants. You know, in this case, it's God. And surrounded by the angels, the heavenly beings. And as you say, into the court comes Satan. First time, by the way, we get that word in the Bible. And it's really ha-Satan. Well, it's more of a title, I guess you would say. The Satan or the Satan. So, first of all, one of the things in this picture, as strange as it looks or seems as we imagine that, is that Satan only comes before the throne of God with permission. That becomes extremely important to our discussion of Job. Everything Satan does is only by permission. He is not allowed free reign, certainly not over the children of God, like Job, the faithful Job, but he must have permission.
But within that permission, it almost looks like Satan and God have a little wager here.
Yes.
From Job.
Right. And it's interesting you think about that because God being God already knows the outcome. God being God is well aware that you should never make a wager with God. God will win because he knows the outcome. I can tell you who can win the lottery. I mean, he knows these things always. He knows how things will turn out. So it is somewhat interesting, consider the character of Satan here and Satan's brashness, his, lack of regard, perhaps, for the attributes of God in this case, as almighty, as all-knowing, as omniscient, and all these various things we talk about. It's as if Satan is dismissing those things out of hand and saying, you don't know what you're doing, and you don't know who Job really is. I know better because I know the human condition. And God says, well, let's just see what you do know, basically. And I will bet you, for lack of a better term, because it is like a wager, I will bet you that Job will come out on the other side okay. And Satan's dumb enough to take the bait.
But God, as you said, puts limitations.
Absolutely.
At least, you know, on the first bit, and then he allows Satan then to go a little further the next time. So, yeah. Again, looking at it from a modern perspective, that, you know, we take a bit of umbrage at God for doing that. That doesn't seem like that's what a loving God would do.
And what is the, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but what's the outcome on the other side? You know, and we don't know that in the beginning. So, and we don't know that, technically we don't know that when Satan walks into the court. God knows. But Satan doesn't know the outcome on the other side, or he wouldn't make this foolish wager. We, as the children of God, don't know the outcome on the other side of suffering or the various things that take place in our lives. Whether we think they're right or wrong or fair or just, whatever, there is always another side. And like in the case of Elijah, as you recall, he went and hid in a cave. And he asked God to get him out of his job description because he didn't like what was going on. He was tired of working. He was tired of being beat up, tired of being threatened. And he asked for a way out. And God comes to him and gives him not a way out, but a way through it, and takes him to the other side of it. And that's what we see happening in Job. You see the beginning, but you always have to remember there's an outcome. There's another side to it. And as you say, limits are placed. God does not allow Satan to take his life.
But the modern reader, listener might protest and say, that's okay for Job. But, you know, those poor sheep, those poor cattle, those poor camels, and those poor kids.
Yeah, yeah.
That all were destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
How do we allow that to filter into our biblical view, then, of a, again, a good and gracious, merciful God?
Well, you remember Jesus once said, when his disciples asked that question, was this man who was born blind, was he born blind because of his sin of his parents or his? And Jesus said, well, let's see if I might paraphrase him. He said, you know nothing. He was born this way in order that God might be glorified. And he then in that case healed him. Then he said, do you think the Tower of Siloam fell when it fell and killed those people? You think it just killed the unbelievers? So that's just not how this works. And so in the case of Job, why do I like those things? Do I like it when the Hurricane Harvey hits and kills people, or Katrina, or all of these things, or the various terrible things that happen within your country, my country? I don't like that. But there is something being accomplished. The trouble is for us is that we're so limited in what we can truly wrap our heads around as far as what is accomplished through what God does. Because suffering always has a purpose. And something is always accomplished through suffering.
Even the suffering of a blameless man like Job. And again, as a Lutheran, when the scripture refers to Job as blameless, I kind of go, oh,
right.
Don't like that. What does that mean, that Job was blameless? But also, can something be accomplished through the suffering of an innocent, blameless man in this case?
Absolutely. Now, first of all, blameless doesn't mean sinless in Old Testament context here. I mean, I'm trying to remember the word he uses, but if it's tamim, which means which has later become sacrificial language for without blemish or spot. You know, it's a perfect sacrifice, but it's not really perfect. Faithful. Job is faithful. Very faithful man. He demonstrates that time and time again, even. And that's really, he's talking about being blameless in his walk. But being faithful and blameless isn't being perfect, because as we know, those things do not equate one to the other. I mean, I suppose if you were perfect, you'd be blameless. But that's a big if. And as we know, as a Lutheran, we really know it, right? So,
and also Job confesses his iniquity and his sin.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
In some of his speeches later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's quick to admit that he is not without sin, that he has sinned. Now, his struggle becomes, but why? I'm a sinner, but I don't remember doing anything to kind of get this kind of treatment. You know, that's what he's struggling with.
And he loses his farm, his animals, mm-hmm. his family. Even his wife says to him, curse God and die.
Yeah, that's a big help.
Yeah, I mean, so it all seems to be gone, and his only hope is God, and God just seems to be his enemy.
Mm-hmm.
How do we, again, as Christians, understand this?
Well, I think that there's a time in our lives at one level or another, perhaps not at a Job level, but a time in our lives, all of us, where we feel like God isn't paying close attention, at the very least, or God is doing something to us that doesn't seem good, right, and proper. That happens all the time. But what I think it comes down to basically for us as Christians is a misunderstanding. I think we've decided somehow along the way, at least according to the self-help aisle in the Christian bookstore, we've decided that suffering is a problem and suffering is evil. And those are both false, according to Scripture. Suffering is not evil, and it's not really a problem. I mean, how many books are called The Problem of Suffering, you know? Well, the problem with the problem of suffering is suffering is not a problem. Suffering is something that God gives and uses to strengthen us, to build us, and to point us to the suffering of Christ.
But Job would say, hey, I'm in the middle of this, Doc.
Yes.
This is a problem because I'm living it.
Yep. Looks different in the middle.
I'm getting the pot sheared and scraping the sores off my body. I'm mm-hmm. telling you, it's real. It's mm-hmm. painful. And I don't know what to do because everybody's gone, and it even feels like God mm-hmm. hates me.
Yeah.
Not just abandoned me, but hates me. Job, however, confesses, you know, I came in naked, I'm going out naked, mm-hmm. the Lord's will be done. Is mm-hmm. that helpful to us, or is Job just kind of being a stoic there?
No, I think it's helpful to an extent. I think everybody, it's ironic, I mean, every Christian I know can relate to the story of Job on one level or another. On the other hand, they don't understand the story of Job on any level, frequently. But somehow or another, something about Job that's very visceral, that grabs hold of them where they're at, sort of like Psalms of Lament, you know. These things are, oh, I feel just like that. But then it doesn't answer the question for them, or they don't quite, you know, understand either why it speaks to them at that level, or, well, if it does, then where is it going? How is this helpful to me? So I do think there is much for us to learn and to focus upon here on the book of Job when we read this. But there's a lot of strange things going on that I found many people misinterpret. And they don't quite understand the basic pattern of what takes place here.
So can you help enlighten us then? What is the basic pattern?
Well, once we get Job in the midst of his suffering, his friends show up. Here's three friends. And the first thing is kind of interesting culturally, which I always fascinates me, this kind of Eastern culture thing. But for 7 days, they sit there. They don't say a word. They're just exercising, if we will, a ministry of presence. They're there to support him in his illness, in his suffering, in his pain. And I think that's actually a very good picture of the role of the church. Unfortunately, when they do start talking, it's not a good thing. They got bad theology, if I might say it that way. They get it all wrong. They are very pop culture theology, if you will. The proper term, I suppose, would be retribution theology. If you do something bad, you're going to suffer for that. If you do something good, good things will happen to you. So, Job, you are suffering. This is terrible stuff. You must have done something really bad. Which, of course, is false theology. That's the theology that Job's friends, really, as you read through Job, you just feel like you can almost see Job being beat down and worn out by these ongoing discussions and pounding at Job, you got to figure out what you did wrong and get over it or repent or something. And Job's like, I didn't do anything like that. And then the young kid comes in named Elihu. I always call him a seminary student because he knows everything and he's smarter than all the other people in the room. But he says basically the same thing. He gets a few things right, but basically he leads Job down the same path. He too says, Job, you're obviously missing something here. Figure it out. And Job continues to proclaim and profess his innocence here. However, I think this is a part we frequently miss. You watch carefully and Job will slowly turn and start to spout some of the same theology. And this is when he begins to, if you will, whine and question God at a different level. And when that happens, of course, God shows up and God looks up. I mean, and he stands Job on his feet. He says, Job, stand up. You want to ask me questions? That's fine. But first, I'd like to have you answer a few questions that I have for you. And then we start. And it goes for quite a few chapters. Really, you can imagine Job slowly sinking back down until he's facing the dirt. And he confesses that he spoke of things he did not know and did not understand. And God says, well, Job, I forgive you. And I'm going to restore all this stuff to you. But Job, I think I want you to offer sacrifice for your friends. Otherwise, I'm going to kill them. Now, the big question I ask, why does Job get to talk bad theology, which he does, but his friends are going to be killed? Why does Job get to question God? Well, the answer is that Job is a Hebrew and he's in the covenantal relationship with God. When you're in the covenantal relationship, you have permission to ask these kind of questions. You even have permission to be wrong. God will sort it out. But you have a permission to lament because you're in this relationship. Unbelievers don't have that permission. And Job's three friends don't have Hebrew names. Notice who doesn't get talked about. The young kid, Elihu. Elihu is a Hebrew name. He had permission to be wrong too. Okay, so Job has permission to engage God on this level because he's in this relationship. And so does Elihu, but the three friends don't. They need to be sacrificed for, which Job does, but they need to be taken care of. Otherwise, God's going to take them out. So in that, you see a couple of things that they're kind of important and significant. The idea that Job at no time is outside of God's love and grace. God is, if you will, he is carefully monitoring the situation to make sure things don't go too far. Now, we always say and we read scripture that says he won't let you be tempted beyond what you can, with the help of God, bear up under. Well, this is certainly true for Job as well. God is monitoring this whole scenario, this situation very carefully. He's not going to let Job go over the brink. He won't let it happen. On the other hand, he's going to call Job to account and say, okay, hey, Job, you're smart. Tell me, where did I store the snow, and where do I put the darkness, and, you know, how does the eagle fly, and where were you when I laid the foundations? Yeah, surely you know, Job. Come on. You're asking all these questions. Surely you must know. And he does remind Job of who he is and who God is.
And I think it's interesting that Job really does know that, because if you go back to some of his earlier laments, I think chapter 7, chapter 9, he says, who can stand before God?
Right.
I didn't, you know, I wasn't there when the stars were put into place. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there when God did this.
Yeah, when he starts in the early laments, and you're exactly right, he says the very things that God says, well, surely you must know these things, Job. These things come back around then in, what is it, chapter 38, around that area, right? So these things come right back around, almost some of the same language that God puts it right back and said, well, Job, come on, you just said. So, yeah, it's a very, very interesting way the text does that, how it just brings it all back around again. Right back into Job's lap again.
Okay. So Job makes sacrifices for his friends, and everything is restored back to Job. We have a happy ending.
Yep.
Again, does this not teach us, or some would say, it teaches us that if we just hang in there, it's all going to come good in the end, and God's going to give us rich health, wealth, and prosperity beyond our dreams. That's what the book is teaching us?
Well, that's a very common interpretation, obviously, out there, and you can find it in many commentators, but that's really not the answer at all. I mean, Job, and even Job himself says things, you know, well, I was naked when I came out of my mother's womb, and I will go back naked. And so Job tells us he doesn't necessarily expect that. That's not within Job's expectation. What Job is asking for, though, is understanding. It seems to me that his main question isn't why me, but what are you doing? Now, why me is probably wrapped up in there, but I think the main question is trying to understand what God is trying to accomplish. And I don't think Job, as I recall, ever asked to have anything restored. He just asked for understanding.
And I don't think he ever asked why.
Never really does. Never really asks, why me, Lord? It's really not the kind of, I mean, I guess you could interpolate that by saying, well, I didn't deserve this, so I don't understand, but I think it's more of, I just want to understand. I'm not saying I don't deserve it. I know I haven't done anything to deserve to be punished, but that doesn't mean, and again, something we read into Job that may not be there at all, it doesn't mean Job's saying, I should never have to suffer, because that's not how he talks. He just talks about saying, but I didn't do anything that this, you do bad, you get bad. That's not, he understands, especially in the beginning, he's very clear on that. Now he gets, like say, he starts to schwaffle as things get tougher, but he really doesn't seem to be confused by the idea of suffering as much as, I just want to understand exactly what's going to be accomplished through this. That seems to be the big thing. What's it look like, if I might return to a very earlier point, what's this supposed to look like on the other side? What will this be like? Because right now in the middle of it, it's just really not great.
So you talk about seeing through to the other side then, and seeing things from God's perspective. How does Job 19, the great resurrection passage, if you will, fit into that? Is that Job actually himself seeing through the clouds and the mist to the other side?
Well, I think it is. I think he sees the ultimate other side. You know, heaven, you know, when I die, when my flesh has thus been destroyed, I shall see God, you know, and then from my flesh I shall see God, which is, by way, a great bodily resurrection text, of which there are not a lot of them in the Old Testament, you know, half a dozen. But a beautiful, putting yourself in the place of Job at this point, what you see is Job really is ready to go. He's ready to move on, ready to die. In fact, in some ways, you wonder, is he praying to die or is he looking forward to death because he sees that as being a great blessing to him. He understands resurrection. He understands all of that. And to him, you know, it would be okay to get there quicker because this is not a lot of fun. And I think, you know, think of people today who are suffering terrible things or we talk as pastors, we go and we visit our neighbors and our friends and members over at the hospital going through terrible, terrible pain. And we know that the end is most likely death. And yet it lingers. And you're like, oh, to me, those are Job. Those people probably understand Job better than we ever will, or at least understand it now, you know, because they understand this. Here I am in the midst of this. I know what it looks like ultimately on the other side, but I'm really not tracking why it's necessary for this to continue on.
And within that section, Job talks about his Redeemer. What does that mean? What's that word all about?
Yeah, the Gaol, you know, the Redeemer. From the Old Testament standpoint, Redeemer has its roots in this the kinsman redeemer type of thing, that land, possessions, even children and wives, etc., can be redeemed by the closest relative. In other words, there's a hierarchy or a progression of which relative is responsible first to redeem. You can redeem the land. But the land comes with, you know, we see this with Ruth, for instance, you know, and Boaz says, you know, and the guy says, yes, I'll redeem the land. Oh, by the way, it comes with this Ruth. And I'm sure the guy's thinking, my wife's going to kill me if I bring home another woman. So he says, nope, I'm not, I don't want it. And Boaz says, okay, I'll redeem them both. I'm next in line. You know, well, when he talks redeemer here, Job, he sees that who restores, the one who restores. I think another place, maybe it's the Psalms where you hear redeem my life from the pit, you know. So this idea of redemption, redeeming is a restoration. And yet Job sees restoration far different than at this point. He's not thinking restoration of all this stuff like what happens. He sees this as restoration of his entire being in the courts of heaven.
And his relationship with God.
Yeah, back into that perfect, into the ultimate presence of God. You know, that's the perfect face-to-face relationship, panim a panim, that we talk about in the Old Testament, you know, the face-to-face relationship that we lost in the garden.
Well, we've been talking about the book of Job, and in that context, we've talked about some suffering. So we're going to impose some suffering upon our listeners now as we're going to make them wait another week till we continue our conversation. So we'd invite them all back next week at this time as we continue our conversation with Professor Jeffrey Pulse on the book of Job. Jeff, thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.